Hi, I'm Jay Washburn.
I'm Joe Bendosky.
And this is Start Writing.
And today we are going to be discussing villains and antagonists. And so the reason this came up is I was writing my short story, which eventually evolved into a novella. And to keep it short, I tried to stay only in the POV of the main character. And what happened was the villain antagonist side was incredibly undeveloped because of that reason. And as I was reading through it in one of the revisions, I was like, this is terrible. And the reason it was terrible is because the villain and antagonist was so underdeveloped. Like you didn't even realize they were present in the novel, which killed a lot of the tension. And so I decided to go back through and add in a few chapters from the antagonist's viewpoint.
Cool.
So that's when I decided, you know, let's really research this and really do a good job here. And so we are then putting together an episode on it. We're going to get rid of this month in critiques. I got two emails over the last 2 months, I think, where people mentioned that what they really like is kind of the meat of the episode. And so I figured this will just let us get into that quicker.
Yeah.
No one has ever mentioned that they really like these. And so I think, you know, it ends up just being us chatting before. And, so we're just gonna skip them and go right into the thing. Now, this is not gonna be a regular thing we're gonna do, but, as I was studying the last week or two, I came across this exercise for writing and I thought it was really good. One of the things they mentioned is just talking about any kind of artistic endeavor, and that is you can't learn painting by looking at a Picasso. Like, you don't learn how to paint just by looking at it. And you can't learn to play the cello by listening to Yo-Yo Ma. Like, that's not how that works. So there's this idea in the writing community that you have to read a lot. Now, I'm not discounting that, but the idea behind this is that alone is not enough to learn how to tell a story. And what these other artistic fields do is they do emulation. You play the great works of musicians and in so doing learn what makes great music. Or people will draw or paint these great paintings done by these masters. They emulate that work to learn how the masterpiece is created. And so the exercise they proposed was that you read a chapter from an author you really like, and then you rewrite that chapter the way you would, and then you kind of compare the two and see maybe why theirs worked and yours isn't, or maybe what you think would make theirs even better. And then this is the one that really I thought was interesting. Do the same thing with an author you hate.
Whoa.
And see what comes out the other end there. So I thought that was a really good exercise, and kind of the theory behind that made a lot of sense to me. Be like, yeah. It's not enough just to read these great writers, but you got to kind of emulate it and then see how yours is different than theirs and why. So
treat it like it's a decent first draft and see where you can take it from there.
Yeah. All right. So antagonists and villains. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to talk about how these terms are different, because they're often used interchangeably and many times they can be. But the real definition here is the antagonist is someone who opposes the protagonist, and the villain seeks to do evil. So you can see how that's different. So stories where the protagonist is the villain is where this really kind of comes out. So you've got stories like Breaking Bad, where he is the meth kingpin, right? He is the villain.
I've actually never watched that, but yeah, I get the gist.
But he's not the antagonist. So there was another one called Payback. It was a story of just he was kind of a thug criminal, and, you know, he was the protagonist. So, if we look at Walter White in Breaking Bad, the antagonist is his brother-in-law who's in drug enforcement. That's the antagonist, because he's actively working against Walter White, even though he doesn't know who he's working against.
So have you seen, is that Tom Hanks stranded on the desert island? Oh, Castaway.
Yeah.
So Castaway has an antagonist, which is nature, but no villain. Like, is that fair
right
to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, and even like Jurassic Park. In Jurassic Park, we have antagonists, but not villains. Raptors are not evil. They're just hungry.
No, Newman. Newman's the villain.
Well, he dies Newman. Like really early. So he's not even like the antagonist because he dies so early in the story that you know he doesn't. You know, he starts the chain event, but he's not actively opposing the main characters throughout the whole story. That's the raptors and the T-Rex that do that. But they're not villains. They're just hungry.
Right.
So. One of the things we want to point out here is just how important they are into the story, right? It is the villain and the antagonist that define your protagonist, right? The Dragon Slayer only bears that title because he slays the dragon, right? Mm-hmm. Without it, he's just a dude with a sword. You know, that is the villain defining the hero. In that way. But
dude, that's a great metaphor. I'm writing that.
Writing that one down.
That's good stuff.
But here's the thing that that one of the authors I was studying up on pointed out. They said, how many journal entries, interviews, backstory did you prepare for your protagonist? Did you do any of that for your antagonist or villain? Right. This is not the second most important character in the story. They are on par with the protagonist. Mm. They bear an equal burden of making the story great. But if you haven't developed them the way you develop your protagonist, then half the story is being ignored. Their half. Right. And as I pointed out, that's where the tension comes from. Right. That is where the suspense comes from, is that antagonist presence in the story. So if you're underdeveloping them, then you're underdeveloping tension and suspense and some of the key things that really make stories interesting.
Are we going to talk about this in a first, in a strictly first-person case?
No. Most novels are written in third-person. So, I mean...
Well, most.
Yeah, most.
Not all.
Not all. We will talk about it. So we do talk. We will talk about the absent antagonist.
Okay. Well, yeah, we can say because, I want to talk about it, but if you've got it scheduled, let's move on.
Because, there is first-person novels, but there's also murder mysteries where to truly be a mystery, you can't meet the antagonist. Otherwise, there's no mystery. You already know. That changes your genre from mystery to suspense and thriller, right? Yeah. In a thriller, you know the antagonist. In mystery, you don't. So we will talk about those things.
Okay.
We'll even talk about what happens... Like, because there's several genres of literature where the antagonist and the protagonist are people who are very much connected and love and care about each other, right? Like books about relationships, you know. So there's some interesting genres where you're still going to have antagonists, but it is definitely more complicated than hero and villain.
Okay, cool.
So, all right. So the first thing is make sure you get their thing in. So now we have some basic principles. So the first principle, we call it action and intention. The protagonist, to really be a good protagonist, must take active actions and have intentions, right? We've talked about this in many podcasts, particularly in dealing with how they're going to conquer the antagonist, right? They have to have this active role. Well, in the same way, the antagonist needs to have an active intention in stopping or slowing the protagonist. Right, we see this very clearly in Harry Potter. Voldemort is coming up with all kinds of schemes for Harry Potter all the time. He is actively trying to kill him.
Well, and so, like, that's something you should always look for in your hero to make sure that they are active. And so you're just saying, repeat that exact same rule. Repeat it.
Exact same rule. Yeah,
I like that.
So now. We say that they have to be actively trying to stop them, but again, let's go back to Jurassic Park. Dr. Grant wants to escape the island. The raptors just want lunch. But those two goals put them in direct opposition with each other, because if Grant gets off the island, raptors don't get lunch, right? Now, they're not, it's more, it feel the motivations behind that come at indirect angles, right? But at the same time, the way that physically plays out is direct opposition. Both cannot coexist.
So you want a zero-sum game.
You do. Want a zero-sum game there. So another element you can kind of throw into this is a contradiction of personality. So this kind of takes it to a deeper level. just showing how much these two people are kind of fundamentally opposed to each other. So if one is a conservative Republican, the other a liberal Democratic. One drinks wine, the other whiskey. So these do not strengthen the conflict between them two, but rather strengthens the fundamental opposition of them against each other, right? They don't...
Like thematic opposition.
Yeah, so this is more... It builds a deeper layer to it, but doesn't necessarily impact the way they conflict with each other.
Well, and I'll call this like setting up foils, right?
Yeah, it's kind of setting up a foil. Raising the stakes. So this is something you'll hear in writing classes all the time or in very basic things. So what does it mean to raise the stakes? Essentially, this comes down to the action of the antagonist, right? The hero is trying to do something, and eventually they succeed. And then the antagonist raises the stakes. They try something more resource demanding, more intense, more likely to succeed at stopping the hero, right? In the first Harry Potter book, we have Professor Quirrell, who's there at the school, and he's kind of a timid guy. You know, he's not the best agent you could send, but Harry Potter's a 12-year-old boy, right? How bad could it be? That fails. You send a basilisk, right? Like, let's get serious here. So that raising of the stakes is usually an active decision by the antagonist to oppose the successes of the protagonist. They raise the stakes of the game because they don't want to fail either.
So... If your two characters are in a knife fight, it's the villain who's going to pull out the gun and raise the stakes, right? Because if your hero pulls out a gun, he's the villain. Like, he's the one with the dirty tactics now because he just, like, upped the game, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. So we talked about this in our Pinch Point episode in Star Wars, right? Part of what makes Vader the villain is... that he's the superior force, right? Like, if you know, no matter how you write this story, if you've got like a 110-pound kid fighting, you know, a 300-pound muscled 25-year-old, no matter how you write that story, it looks like the kid is the protagonist and the other guy is the villain, right?
Yeah, no matter what.
No matter what, because he's just beating the tar out of him, right? And so you do, it is the antagonist who raises the stakes that way. Because that is what maintains them as the antagonist.
Okay. Yeah, wow. Cool.
But yeah, and so raising the stakes, you're going to be doing that through your antagonist, through their choices, their active opposition to the protagonist. Second principle is understanding the path of redemption. So... we are dealing with people who are often villains, these antagonists. And it adds a complexity to the character if we kind of see a path where they could be redeemed, right? This path of redemption, okay. this hope. Not only that, but then we become invested in the internal conflict of them because we wonder, is this villain redeemable? And that changes... the dynamic of the story, it adds a lot deeper level, but that comes by us understanding and empathizing with them, right?
So that made me think of Gollum and Frodo.
Yeah, and Gollum is a great,
Frodo needs Gollum to be redeemable because that means he himself will be. And Sam doesn't see it and doesn't need it, really. He doesn't understand what's going on.
He doesn't understand what's going on. So as Chuck Wendig puts it, antagonists are just people, unless they're insane sex bots, sentient washing machines, serial killer dinosaurs, or hyper-intelligent window treatments. But even then, we need to treat them like people.
Nice.
Right? And I think, you know, you point out, you know, there's this The Lord of the Rings, the possible redemption of Gollum, right? Like, I don't know how many people really connect to that, but you do. You hope that he can be redeemed, you know?
Yeah.
And you see that
he is
him.
Frodo. Like, he's in the same path, just a little further along.
Just further along the same path. And that's why you know Frodo needs to find redemption for Gollum, because he too is aware of where this is all headed.
Yeah. Man, and he almost gets redeemed, which is like... such a cool part of the story, but he doesn't, and it's just this great tragedy, such good drama.
Yeah. So even in slasher monster movies, the antagonist kind of serves its purpose. And this is kind of drawing on the ancient culture of the execution of the guilty, right? And throughout most human history, executions were a thing. And they were, it was the exercising of justice before the people. And like the detailed accounts of some of these executions, it's this marathon event of extracting justice and redemption for the person in the execution. And then there's this very short window in history where we're without it, right? Society progresses to the point that says we're not doing public executions anymore. And then there's this tiny window, and then we get slasher stories, right? Which are essentially...
Dude, I love how you put the history together like that.
which is the bringing back of the execution story, which is not about the killer and the executioner. It is about the justice for the guilty.
So I haven't seen a lot of slasher movies, but to me it sounds like you're saying the slasher is a hero, or like
the kind of their
own a good role,
right? Yeah. Well, and this kind of goes back to the old time story of the executioner, right? They wore the mask so they wouldn't be seen by the people, but everyone still knows who they are, and this is then the burden carried by this profession, right?
Wait, but in a slasher movie, are the Is there still a protagonist that's trying to kill the slasher?
No, the protagonist tries to get away from the slasher, which kind of creates this,
escape. Okay.
This interesting duology. And the interesting thing that usually the protagonist of a slasher movie is the innocent who is essentially wrongly accused, right? And that's the then story being told, that the guilty will be punished, but the wrongly accused will escape the executioner's blade.
Wait, so the slasher's like murdering people who deserve it.
Yeah.
And wrongly thinks that the hero deserves
it. In Save the Cat, right, he refers to this whole group of movies as monster in the house, whether that's a person or an actual monster or something like Jurassic Park, right? And the whole idea is that anyone that we've actually met who is killed by the monster has to have committed some kind of sin in society.
Yeah, the lawyer in Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
When he goes, the audience just like, yeah, that dirty weasel. Like he was.
And so that's
all he cared about was money.
And so there is this kind of weird slant on the slasher movies that kind of says the executioner is in his own way a protagonist, and the person presented as the main character is more the unjustly accused, and thus they must escape the executioner's blade. This is kind of an odd tangent
because it's a weird
dynamic of storytelling that has come about as we've had changes within societal justice. So it's not as closely adherent to a lot of the models of storytelling. Pure evil is hard to understand and relate to. And because we don't see ourselves as evil. And outside of fiction, we never encounter just raw evil. We get really frustrated and angry with people. But and we do encounter people with cross motives to our own. But even if your book is just a single POV in the first person, you have the POV character can try to understand the antagonist. Right. So this is one of the, like, you don't get to see into their mind with that first person POV, or even if you're just writing single POV, but you can have the protagonist try to understand the person they're competing with as a way to introduce that. So as we mentioned before, you're going to need to have a very well developed antagonist for them to peer into that, because otherwise there's nothing to look into. Right. Like even with the raptors, right, you try to understand why they're hunting and why they're hunting you, right?
No, so this makes me think of like Nazi Germany. And I feel like the concept of a Nazi can be kind of terrifying, but it's, I think, in a way more frightening to realize maybe the small steps that a particular Nazi took in order to commit those horrors, right? Because suddenly you can see that in yourself, like, and it's scary to have that look inside yourself. Like you can see yourself in the Nazi. So like you say, to relate to, once you relate to that horror, like it's almost more horrifying.
Yeah.
It was personal. Now.
I recently read The Girl on the Train, and because you're in her head the whole time, you see her rationalizing things. And the way she rationalized things is very much like I have seen myself rationalize decisions in that same way. At the same time, she is legit crazy, man. She has done some legit crazy stuff. But the way she rationalizes those decisions are the way anyone rationalizes decisions. And while she does crazy things, you can kind of like, well, I kind of get it. You know, we've all done dumb stuff. Wow. But I mean, she's legit crazy. But that doesn't come out till later. You're already connected to her. You understand
Sounds
her.
Sounds like a cool book.
Oh, it is. Like, just the way you connect to this character before you find out she's legit crazy. I think one of the great thing, a great example of this is in the Red Rising series. You have what's called the Society. And so the first three books are all about overthrowing this society that has enslaved some of its people. And after the society is gone, you see how their life is now. And this one character talks about it in this way. So when they say they, the people who led the revolution and started the new government, they say, they lifted us out of the mines to leave us in the mud. No Red dreams of being a hell diver anymore. We don't dream of anything. We were slaves with dreams. Now we are poor with no hope. You know, and so it just talks about, you know, that this, as much as it was seen as very much this terrible evil, this is what happened when that was gone. And so it was, you know, there was definitely decisions that were made that while these people were slaves, they found greater happiness in that than just object poverty because of the way they had structured society. The way society was, they were slaves, but they didn't know they were slaves. They thought they were living on the frontier, preparing the way for humanity, and they took a lot of pride in that. And now they realize we're slaves and we don't really contribute much. You know, now we're just poor and we don't contribute much. And so it really helps you understand the way this old world that had been overthrown was constructed with concerns about the happiness, even of the people who were enslaved. Like, we wanted to make sure that they had hopes and dreams and were happy with their lot.
So you're saying in book four, you finally get this insight into the evil that you never had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, fourth principle. Abstractions make terrible antagonists. And so that is like the corporation, the religion. And the point is that these, like, a corporation doesn't make a decision. A religion does not make a decision. There are people at the top who do, right? And they, you know, whenever a corporation or a large organization is blamed for a decision, that's just people avoiding being blamed is what that is. And so you want to really bring to forefront those people and not necessarily those corporations, because it is easier to have an empathic reaction, positive or negative, to a person, because people elicit emotions from us. That's just how we're wired, as opposed to just this vague entity.
So in Star Wars, they always, never mind, you already got that.
In Star Wars, the villain and the antagonist is the Empire, but it has a face, Darth Vader, right?
Well, and like it's multiple someone, faces. You also think of the Emperor.
Yeah, throughout the series. It gets more. But it is someone you can see, fear, and fight. So on to the fifth principle. Balance. The stronger your antagonist, the brighter the star of the protagonist when he wins. So this kind of comes back to pinch points when we talked about it here. But there's another point of balance we want to look at as well. So one is that, you know, that the dragon defines the dragon slayer, right?
Yeah, I love that.
But another point of balance is that if the antagonist is too godlike, then you know the victory is just going to be a technicality. So if we look at the conflict between Harry Potter and Voldemort, if Voldemort is at the peak of his power, facing off against 12-year-old Harry Potter, who barely knows anything of magic, you know the victory's
going to... Never studies.
Jeez. Yeah. You know the victory's going to be a technicality because Harry can't win. There's no way, right?
Wait, so you're saying the technicality's bad, right?
Yeah, the technicality's bad.
Because it's not a real victory.
It's not a real victory. But what we have then is that Harry grows in his power throughout the series, ever getting stronger, and we learn more of the complexity of the wizarding world. so that when he faces off against Voldemort, he has been preparing for this for a long time, and the trials have made him stronger, and he is wielding the Eldritch Wand, because it won't work for Voldemort anymore. Mm. Right? So now, Harry has a chance. He's got a fighting chance against this dark wizard, because of all his experience and wielding this incredibly powerful wand. Conversely, I saw the Infinity Wars, and that's how I felt about Thanos. I was like, we're looking at a technicality victory. He is unstoppable, literally. And so I was like, it's just going to be a technicality victory. And I was just waiting for it, which they actually don't really do. But I was like,
you're still waiting.
Still waiting for it. But I mean, that's like about halfway through the movie, I was like, this is a technicality victory. That's what's coming.
Well, but now, since there's a sequel, now there's time at the beginning of the next movie to make the Avengers strong enough to meet that challenge.
Yeah.
So it's possible
that they won't do
that. The story can still be saved.
Yeah. But the way the story was playing out, you're like, yeah, no, you've made it too powerful. We got a technicality victory on our way here.
Mm-hmm.
So. let's go on to the sixth principle. So this is, we're talking about when the protagonists and the antagonists love each other, but they are still protagonist and antagonist. And this happens a lot in like women's fiction. So if you think of a wife who maybe wants to go back to school, reinvent herself, and her husband thinks it's a bad idea. Now that's our protagonist and antagonist. They are still in a loving relationship, but surrounding these events, sometimes there's a protagonist-antagonist relationship.
Huh.
You know, or maybe an adult who thinks their aging parent protagonist should be put in a nursing home, right? So again, we've got a parent-child relationship that is now becoming protagonist-antagonist.
Well, and the opposite sometimes, too. I feel like in a lot of YA fiction, the kid is the hero and the parent is, like, getting on their case or, like, setting up rules. But, yeah.
And so, again, you need to identify who is the antagonist there, and they will be taking active roles to dissuade them, right? So this may not be like, you know, villainous actions, right? The husband may not, like, be locking his wife in her room so she can't go to school, but maybe he's distracting her. She's got homework. People are like, come on, let's go out just this one time. You can do it when we get back. And then they get back so late and she can't get the homework done, so she's failing the classes. You know, and so he is still intentionally opposing her goals, but he's not being mean to her. He's just distracting her with things they enjoy doing so that she will give up on school.
Well, I think that happens in real life a lot, where we can have similar goals but not the same goals. And even if they're slightly off, you're still going to have conflict.
Yeah.
So you said... Well, yeah, I think there's actually a lot of rich drama in a relationship like that.
Yeah.
Like, there's some good story there.
So this is not a genre I read a lot, so I can't come up with really good examples for it. But as you look at your story, this may be the kind of protagonist-antagonist relationship you're looking at. And again, you need to be developing that antagonist so that they have goals that then put them in opposition to your protagonist to develop that tension and conflict. Seventh principle. This is the mysterious or unseen antagonist.
Okay, yeah.
You're like, this is the one I wanted to talk about. So these are common in mysteries, but they appear in other novels as well. And one way... So there's a couple ways to approach this. One is by having the lieutenants or the proxies present to fight at the command of the true antagonist, right? So you
see... It's like the stormtroopers showing up.
Yeah.
And Darth Vader isn't there.
Yeah, Darth Vader's not there, but you've got stormtroopers. Or like Harry Potter. Harry Potter fights a myriad of people sent by Voldemort before he actually fights Voldemort for the first time. Mm-hmm. Or even the last time. Like, you have that one fight during like book four, and then again, we don't see him again face off against each other till much later. But again, there are always these lieutenants and these proxies standing in. Or as you said, you know, there are the sentinels. So if we talk about the Hunger Games, right, you have the arena where they're fighting each other, but then the gamekeepers make active decisions to send problems at Katniss, right? And that is where it is Snow, who is kind of, you know, Snow and the Gamekeeper are the faces.
Yeah, but that's true. Katniss is distant from Snow the whole time, basically.
Yeah. But so the proxies, it's hard for us. The representatives, yeah, are sent to fight her. So.
Well, so I had this trouble with Song of Locke. I actually wrote a really good backstory for my villain, but I wanted it to be the sylph that narrates the story who didn't have access to that backstory. And so in the late draft, I'm basically trying to fit in as much of that as I can, but it's so difficult when the constraints of how you're telling the story don't allow that. Mm-hmm. So, I face this problem. There are definitely minions that come out, like you said,
yeah,
and kind of illustrate the...
They manifest the opposition to the protagonist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all this stuff we talked about having like a rich character that's real and that's human, like that's all in my villain, but it's not in the story.
That's the problem.
Yeah. No, I do think, yeah, it is a problem.
Yeah.
But, well, yeah. So, but there's a trade-off, and that's what you get by seeing it strictly from the protagonist's side. Mm-hmm. And that allows you to really, I guess, empathize. You're on the, yeah, exact same page. So, yeah. It's a problem, but I think there's also a benefit by taking that.
Yeah. So if we look at more of a mystery, so the Hunger Games is told in first person, and that's how we see the manifest of the true antagonist, Snow, right? Which is, he has these proxies that are sent to fight against Katniss, but they go at his bidding. Whereas in a mystery, sometimes you don't even have these proxies, but like a lot of times what happens is more bodies show up, or sometimes somebody chases the protagonist and you never see who it is, or you may not even see them. You just hear them, and maybe there's a few gunshots and stuff, right? Like you'll see that kind of stuff in like a Sherlock Holmes. But the antagonist is not actually revealed until the end.
Man, and that's actually really powerful. Like if you think of Jaws, how like the story – have we told this on the podcast about how you couldn't see the shark because the mechanical shark wasn't working, so they didn't film until like the shark, you only see him at the very end. But the, yeah, mystery of just like seeing the swishing water and the blood in the water, like,
yeah,
it's actually a really good villain because they couldn't film
and the bodies are mounting up.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so
that mystery, that veiled, like that shadowy figure can be,
yeah, and so can be powerful. Know, but there is still this active opposition. And that is through these bodies showing up, you know, and so it's still there, even though the antagonist himself does not show up in the story. The evidence of their labor is there.
Yeah. Well, and he does show up in the end, so you still hopefully get more of that.
So, yeah. And we will have more in part two.
Good. That was good stuff. Villains.
And antagonists. Thanks for listening. We would love it if you would leave us a review on whatever platform you listen to us. Recommend us to a fellow writer friend if you think we've got some good episodes here. Email us. We like it. So if you want to tell us what you like or don't like, we read through those. If you want to look up the articles that we use for the episodes for further research, particularly like the marketing ones where you kind of want to be going back and forth as you're editing and doing stuff, you can find those on our website. That's joseph-mendoski.com/start-writing. And if you want to support us, check out one of our books.
Guys, thanks for listening. It's time to start writing.